It's being called a bipartisan effort. Senator Brian Schatz introduced a bill with two other Congress members that would put the responsibility of alerting the public about a possible missile threat into the hands of the federal government. He talks about the chances the bill has of advancing and why it's being called the Common Sense Bill.
Well, the basic idea is very simple, and it is that the people who know whether or not a missile is coming for sure are the people that ought to inform the public. There are lots of valid arguments about the role of the federal government versus the role of the state or local government that we have in the Congress, but you know, my view is that there's nothing more federal than an incoming ICBM. NORAD for the mainland or PACOM for Hawaii makes a determination about whether or not a missile is coming, and they ought to be the ones to tell the public. The system that we have right now, first of all, it's voluntary, and we only have one state participating, and that's us. We also have 3,017 counties across the country, so the idea that we're going to get 3,017 counties, 50 states, and all five territories setting up their own infrastructure, setting up their own systems to do this makes no sense when, in fact, with the FEMA software that already exists, with the authority under federal law existing for a presidential alert, and with the fact that the people who will make a determination about whether or not a missile is on its way is the DOD, it really makes sense for this authority and responsibility to reside with the federal government.
Our experience last month with the false missile alert really did call into question the state's ability to issue a proper alert, you know, whether it's we had a poorly designed interface system, software system, and then there was just, you know, the potential for operator error.
There are too many opportunities for this to get messed up, and obviously there were a number of inexcusable mistakes made locally, but the truth is if you have 3,017 counties and 49 other states volunteering to participate in this program, the likelihood of another mistaken missile alert is not zero. On the other hand, the likelihood of a mistaken missile alert, if it's coming from the National Security Council, is pretty darn close to zero. And what we want is a system that is federal because we think people will more likely be able to rely upon its veracity.
And what have we heard from the feds about accepting this responsibility?
We've been working collaboratively with the White House, with the National Security Team, with FEMA, with DOD, and with the FCC. They continue to work with us at the technical level. We've got two Republican co-sponsors, and myself and Senator Harris from California working on this bill. We anticipate being able to offer this as an amendment to the Department of Homeland Security reauthorization bill in the Homeland Security Committee. So we're making reasonably good progress, and I think maybe the most important thing for the likelihood of passage is that this has not gotten caught up in partisan politics. We're making pretty good progress, and everyone's just trying to figure out how to make this work best.
What kind of opposition do you think you might get on this bill?
You know, we haven't received any serious opposition. It's not that it won't occur. We just don't know who objects to this. I don't think the state or local management agencies actually want this authority. It's a tremendous responsibility. And, you know, in the end, they're still going to be downstream from the information coming either from NORTHCOM or PACOM. So having this responsibility without having the information at their fingertips, I think, is an uncomfortable position to put them in. And, you know, the first time this was tried, it just didn't work. And so you do not have a lot of county or state emergency management agencies clamoring for the opportunity to do this themselves. I think everybody would feel safer if the federal government very clearly had the sole responsibility for notification here.
Now, Senator, I know a number of our listeners called in concerned because they received alerts on base. And I did contact Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam and was told that based on that Hawaii Emergency Management Agency cell phone alert, that a voice announcement to shelter in place was made across some portions of the base. and that eventually an all-clear message went out across what they call the giant voice that broadcast that it was a false alarm and it was an all-clear. And I know the Navy is looking at what happened there, you know, what were the procedures. But, you know, that's a bit of a head-scratcher, too. Like, how did that happen?
Well, we don't know how that happened, but it is part of the analysis. We've asked the Department of Defense for an after-action analysis because clearly this was not originally their fault, but you can learn a lot from what the response was. And the truth is that that PACOM knew that there was no incoming missile, and yet some of our bases and installations mistakenly either set off a siren or some other kind of alert as a result of receiving that push notification. So, that was a downstream mistake, but it's certainly worth cleaning up because if you're on base and you get an alert, that's a terrifying experience. We're working closely with PACOM on that aspect of it, but, you know, this goes back to the basic question of who ought to be in charge of notifying the public, and I believe very strongly that that ought to be the Department of Defense because they're the ones that have the visibility into whether or not a missile is on its way.
So what's the soonest we could expect some action on this bill?
Well, we're hoping to get this bill attached as an amendment to another bill, which is being taken up over the next couple of weeks. It's still the Senate, so that will take a while. But we've got pretty good momentum, and we're going to push as hard as we can.
What about money that might be attached to this?
We're going to do the analysis on whether or not this bill costs any money, but our first instinct is that it should not. The IPAWS system is already funded and already exists. The national security team is already in place. You don't need new staff for this. And, of course, NORAD, NORTHCOM, PACOM are already in the business of determining whether or not their missiles are on the way. So we do not think this will cost any additional taxpayer dollars.
And, Senator, what was your impression of how things went with our wireless alert system? Because obviously many people didn't realize that they had to have a push notification on their cell phone activated in order to get the alert because people were saying, well, I got it, but my husband didn't, and we were standing next to each other. And, you know, so they were a little bit mystified. But now we know. But there's been some concern about testing that system.
Well, one of the things that we're looking at through the FCC process is whether or not you should be allowed to turn off notifications that are related to a missile attack. We understand if someone doesn't want civil defense notifications about flash floods or even amber alerts, but the presidential alert system can override any setting on your phone. And that should be used judiciously, sparingly. But to the extent that people are in danger, we need to make sure everybody knows. For instance, you can't set up your television to prevent the notification from coming onto it. And I'm not sure that you should be able to configure your phone to refuse valuable information.
And, Senator, I know in the last week or so we've been hearing from the so-called button pusher, who I think has hired an attorney, and his side of the story is that he thought it was a real drill, a real thing and not a drill. Any thoughts you can share about the situation there where he just really thought it was a bona fide threat?
It just shows that you need really skilled, highly trained individuals with this level of responsibility. And there was clearly a training problem. There was a software problem. There were errors in human judgment. There were supervision challenges. But all of this adds up to I would like NORTHCOM and PACOM to be in charge of this.
That was Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz talking about his efforts to avoid the missteps of last month's false missile alert by putting it into the hands of the federal government, who would likely be the first to know of any real threat. He sponsored the Authenticating Local Emergencies and Real Threats Act, which would reserve the authority to issue a missile alert for the federal government. We posted a link to more information on the Conversation Facebook page. Now, much of the fear around a nuclear missile is the radiation fallout, but there's also another possible effect that you might not know much about. A nuclear blast can trigger an electromagnetic pulse that would essentially fry your electronics. It could disrupt power grids and telecommunication systems, all tied to technology that we have come to heavily depend on. We talked earlier with Ed Texera, the former head of what was formerly known as the State Civil Defense, now known as the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, about what might be like, about what that might be like. He shared personal experiences with the nuclear testing in the Pacific decades ago.
The question is, the real concern for me, put it this way, the real concern for me and other members of the public is North Korea has been hinting of doing an atmosphere test somewhere in the Pacific. Now, that should offend all of us in the Pacific, let alone all the, at the national level and so on. That is very, very worrisome. And I would hope through diplomacy and through other ways that we basically convince the North Koreans not to do that. Mm-hmm. Even if they test a weapon like that in the Pacific Ocean or over the Pacific Ocean, wherever it's going to be, and if it's, I think, somewhere in the North Pacific, and perhaps this side of the dateline, we may be affected by that particular test, and we can be affected by the test through electromagnetic pulse, which is a natural phenomenon. But that EMP becomes exponential, if you will, when detonated by a nuclear weapon, and it has the potential to basically shut down all of our electronics, perhaps burn out most of our computer systems. So, it is a real concern and real threat. And what EMP is electromagnetic kind of field that's put out when a nuclear weapon is detonated, and that particular wave, just particular its speed of light, and it can just interfere, even burn out radios, anything electronic, electrical, and so on. So basically, even traffic lights could stop working that day if it did happen.
Right, so that's a whole other aspect of a missile that maybe most people hadn't thought about.
I tell people, if I may, Catherine, that I'm an old man of the sea, but I was in my teens in 1962 when the U.S. government detonated a nuclear weapon, I think it was about 1.2 megatons, over Johnston Island in the atmosphere. It was supposed to go off, I think it was July the 9th, 1962. Many of us were on the beach waiting for it to happen. I think it was going to go at 9, was late to 11, and I'll never forget it. You know, it was like somebody with a big flash camera. We were all looking out to the west. I was on the shores of Ewa Beach, Oahu. And all everybody looking out to the west, we heard the countdown on the radio, and when it went off, the radio went silent, and it was like somebody with a giant flash camera taking a picture from above. And as the ball got brighter and brighter, at the brightest point, Catherine, it was like midday. I could see my shadow. I could look across to a Diamond Head and see the whole line of Waikiki as if it was 12 noon. But we also learned about EMP from that particular blast or that detonation. You know, EMP, because all right. The phone systems on Oahu and elsewhere went down.
That was Ed Texera, who most recently worked with the county's Emergency Management Agency and had a long career with what was formerly known as State Civil Defense between 1996 and 2011. We're continuing to hear from you about the false missile threat. Listeners have called in across the state, some wondering about restoring trust in the state agency charged with alerting the public during the threat of a disaster, natural or man-made. A full report on the incident and recommendations on how to avoid a repeat of the mistake is still weeks away. But our listeners called in. They've got ideas to share about their experience.
Hi, Fred Fogel, Volcano, Big Island. Yes, I trust civil defense. Rogue employees can adversely affect any organization. Unfortunately, when it comes to civil defense, the impact extends far past its organizational boundaries. No doubt CD will put changes into effect to minimize the possibility of this impact in the future. But unfortunately, the root cause will probably not be addressed. That's the inability of management within the state civil service system to effectively address problem employees before they go ballistic.
My name is Kyle Matsumura, and I just wanted to address the gentleman you just had on talking about the firing and forgiving. It's not so much that we're not, well, at least I am tired of hearing about what's wrong and that this guy needs to be fired. What I want to hear the media talk about is what improvements are being made. How are we moving forward from this? Instead of dwelling on the issue of this guy's to blame, whose head's to roll, I don't care about that. I want to know what's going to happen next time to prevent something like this to happen, or if something like this does happen again, what improvements have been made that's not going to take 46 minutes to release some kind of statement? And that's all I'm looking for, and I'm not hearing it from the media. Thank you.
My name is Joyce Valeda. I'm a resident of the Puna district of the Big Island of Hawaii. This was not a simple thing of, oh, we made a mistake in a cake baking recipe. This incident affected so many people with so much extreme stress that it can't be swept under the rug. I was at first satisfied that the agency fired that individual. But after listening to more radio reports, I'm convinced absolutely that more scrutiny of that individual is in order here. We need to know exactly why did that person do that.
This is Gregory T. Smith from Puna, Hawaii. My comment is that the incident was extremely unfortunate because the angst that caused the people around the state, particularly people that, you know, were not educated into this type of drill. I'm very happy that, you know, the state has actually instigated this because of the possible threat of, you know, nuclear attack from Korea. But the problem was that the real terror that it did cause people, particularly one of my relatives just gave birth to a 6-week-old baby boy at the time of the incident, and she made the comment of, is this all the time that he has? The good thing is that we did have this happen, and prayerfully the state and the federal officials, county officials, will rectify the situation. Mahalo.
Sean from Kaneohe. I haven't heard the cost of this whole thing. How much did it cost? I know it's preliminary, but what's the cost of this whole debacle? Is the fact that we have a one-party system running the government a cause for the debacle as well? Since we don't have any recourse but to do it the democratic way. Thank you.
Hello, this is Carl from Kapoho calling. I feel like people are just trying to gauze it over. I want people to look at the reality that the siren doesn't make any difference at all. If we're going to get hit with a nuclear explosion, who cares about a siren? Why spend $1.50 on that? Buy some homeless people some food, I say.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, which is 792-8217.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting a screening and discussion, Ku Ka Naka, Stand Tall, Self-Determination and Resilience in the Life of Kanalu Young, this Sunday, mauiarts.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, linking together struggles for indigenous rights from around the world. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're remembering a Honolulu-based newspaper reporter who's credited with inventing the sport of snowboarding. It's a new entry in this year's Winter Olympics. The year was 1938, and our mystery man was vacationing in Yosemite National Park. He wrote a column in the Honolulu Advertiser under the nom de plume Sol Pluvius, while the vacationing colonist tried his surfing skills on a board in the Sierras. A new sport was born. The name didn't stick, though. He called it snurfing for snow surfing, and his newspaper duly reported his invention under that name. He joined the Honolulu Advertiser as a reporter in 1933, rising to city editor 2 years later, and he stayed until 1943 when he became a full-time correspondent for the New York Times covering Asia and the Pacific. We're looking for his name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hi, I'm Steven Salaita from Washington, D.C. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
The late Hawaii Congresswoman Patsy Mink is remembered as a champion of women's athletics. After her death in 2002, the Title IX amendment that mandates gender equality on school athletic programs was renamed the Patsy T. Mink Equal Opportunity in Education Act. Title IX has been the law of the land since 1972. Are its provisions being enforced in Hawaii schools? Civil Beat reporter Suvan Lee has found several schools where they are not, and she tells us in today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, we've long heard about Title IX as it really revolutionizing athletics for women and girls, and we kind of assume that it's in force, but you found out otherwise, didn't you?
Right. It is. One would think that many, many years later, it would be in compliance with schools, but as the case is with many of the Hawaii high schools, that's not true, especially when it comes to these facilities in which girls don't have athletic locker rooms as the boys do at several area high schools, including the state's largest, Campbell, which I profiled in the article.
And you found that that's true at other schools as well, right?
That's right. This is not unique to just Campbell. It's true at several area high schools around the state.
What's going to be done about it? Or, you know, is there some kind of backlash on this?
Well, I think that teachers and coaches, parents and students have known that this has been an issue for a while now. I think that the situation with Campbell is kind of picking up in terms of steam due to the advocacy efforts of several parents. They're bringing it to the attention of lawmakers. Lawmakers are bringing it to the attention of their colleagues. So there's a lot more dialogue happening when it comes to Campbell. But as we know, Title IX compliance is oftentimes brought to the fore by these advocacy efforts. So unless the community really sort of rallies and does their best to sort of bring it up, it can very well just be the same old for many of these students and coaches who've dealt with this issue for years in Hawaii.
Well, once attention is brought to the fact that boys have a locker room and the girls don't, somebody's got to come up with the money, right?
That's right. And I think that's a huge sticking point right now. The Department of Education, to its credit, has requested a lot more funding for facilities than the legislature has doled out. So it's not as if they're not aware of the problem. They are. But the fact is there is only so much money that can go around. And the allocations in recent years for facilities and capital improvement projects just hasn't met those demands. So you have a bit of a disparity there. So we'll see what happens in this session and the ones to come.
Now, you just using Campbell High School as an example, you've got an estimate in your piece of roughly $13.5 million just for what's needed at that school, right?
That's correct.
Idea being that you multiply that by who knows how many schools, that's going to get into real money, probably well beyond the money that's been appropriated for all capital improvements, I would think.
Right. I mean, there's no question about it that the demand far outpaces what's available in the supply. There's plenty of schools here that need, you know, girls' athletic locker rooms in addition to things like a turf field or a synthetic track. And the DOE is just not going to be able to get to all of them in a certain amount of time. So a big question is, how do they prioritize which schools get the facilities first? I wasn't able to get a clear question or a clear answer on that, but gender equity and compliance with disabled rights usage and facilities is a separate category within their funding structure. But beyond that, we don't know exactly how the schools are chosen in terms of order of priority within that category.
I guess all we can do at this point is shine a light on it. Thanks very much for your piece, Simone.
Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Suvan Lee.
Silicon Valley is a pretty sexist place. Has been, in fact, basically forever.
Unfortunately, bad behavior has become the norm, and it's completely hostile for women.
I'm Kai Ruzdahl. How to break up the Silicon Valley Boys Club, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
History is written by the victors, and as a result, the real history of Native peoples all over the world is all too rarely written. When it is, it'll be filled with stories that follow a pattern: human rights taken away by force, destruction of the land and its people by colonizers from far away. Walter Echo Hawk is a Native American attorney and educator who has been involved with struggles for the rights of Native people all his life. As he says, indigenous rights are never freely given. They must be demanded, wrested away, and then vigilantly protected. He's with us in our studio. Walter, thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.
We were talking a little bit before the show, and I was remarking on how you managed to find optimism in what might seem to be, in some ways, a very dreary atmosphere.
Well, I think one always has to have optimism, especially in my line of work, you know, representing Native peoples in the legal arenas. And I've had to purge myself from not having optimism, you know,
I mean, getting sort of bogged down in resentment and anger.
Right, right. In fact, I wrote my book, In the Courts of the Conqueror, which is a critical analysis of the dark side of federal Indian law.
Mm-hmm.
I think in part in an effort to purge myself of disappointed feelings in our judicial system. You know, what most people, when they tend to equate our courts with justice, you know, and mm-hmm. I think that's true in their finest hour. You know, I think our courts hand down wonderful decisions like Brown v. Board of Education mm-hmm. and others that really stir our hearts, you know.
Sure.
In their finest hour, you know, they really do reflect our ideals and values. But there's always this dark side of the law, you know, on the other side of the coin, where at its worst, the courts can actually have a perversion of justice, you know. And there's many examples of that in our legal history, as
sure.
as well as in other countries. So we can't always equate justice with our, you know, courts. Even in our country, you know, that has gone so far to attempt to have a just judicial system. You know, that
has it, Walter. I mean, do you feel that America has gone pretty far in the direction of trying to?
Well, yes. You know, our nation has a very splendid human rights history, you know, beginning from the American Revolution and the writing of the Declaration of Independence. The founding fathers, you know, were aware of the natural rights of inherent rights of man that come to us from a higher source, and very familiar with those kinds of principles that are expressed in the Declaration of Independence. And I think we're on the lips of our people during the rise and expansion of the democracy, but we haven't always lived up to these human right principles.
One could argue, Walter, that we haven't ever lived up to those principles.
Well, I mean,
it's beautiful language. Beautiful language being uttered while your people were being wiped out systematically.
Well, I think that's true. We haven't always lived up to them, but I think, you know, as seen in the slavery institution and the denial of women rights, systematic discrimination of other minorities, treatment of Native Americans, but I think in almost every case, our core values that the founding fathers tried to articulate have impelled us to self-correct, you know. And even though that might be a work in progress, you know, I know on Native peoples, we've come a long ways in recent years. We have an imperfect legal framework, but I think we're standing now at the dawn of a perhaps a new era in defining our Native rights as inherent human rights, which are coming to us now from a modern international human rights law that, if are extended to our Native peoples, could be the last chapter in the American Revolution by extending at long last the founding core values of inherent rights to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness to the Native people of the country. So
it will have taken a while.
Yes.
Walter, you're a great believer in the better angels of our nature that you know, you see as eventually being able to prevail.
I have found as an indigenous rights attorney that most Americans, when educated with the facts at hand, usually act to do the right thing, you know, that our people are a fundamentally fair and just peoples, you know. And I feel that the biggest problem facing Native peoples and has always been this lack of reliable information about Native people, and that once educated, most of our fellow Americans invariably act to do the right thing. And that's the task of our advocates and our attorneys, is to educate policymakers, educate judges, that's been my experience, you know, and therefore that leaves me with a degree of optimism, even though today we do live in troubling times.
Well, those troubling times that we live in are frequently described as times in which the lesser angels of our nature, you know, that we're seeing a resurgence of a number of, racism incidents around the country, of various types of prejudice being acted upon. Do you see the pendulum swinging the other way at the moment?
I do. I feel like this is just my own personal opinion. Yeah. I'm not a sociologist or, but I feel that the Trump era is so out of step with our core American values and debasing those values, you know, that it's going to prompt, I think, a backlash to bring our peoples back to these core values that have always been a very splendid legacy of our people. And so, you know, I feel that we'll bounce back, you know.
A backlash that would bring Native peoples along with it?
Yes, yes. I am very optimistic that we will all see a better day.
Because, you know, we've seen freedom movements in the past, and I'm thinking of the anti-war years and things in which really the rights of Native Americans were not discussed. Is it different now?
No, it's not. And I think that's a failing in the in our public discourse, you know, in the media and the coverage, you know, of our issues and, you know, just generally a lack of understanding of our contemporary indigenous issues.
Solution being what? Education of the public?
I think so. I think we need to learn our histories, and I feel like a lot of our fellow citizens, you know, are that live on the land, you know, are wanting to become more indigenous to the place that we live, and shed aspects of settlerism, perhaps, you know, and are ready to come to terms, you know, with our native peoples, you know, and I feel like we're poised to do that. We've come a long ways under our existing legal framework. Today, we have a lot of educated native people that are very articulate, very versed, and sophisticated in the various professions, you know, and are ready for a discourse about Native peoples. I am optimistic.
Well, you've certainly, you know, it's taken a long journey to get there, I'm sure. Thanks very much for talking with us, Walter.
Been my pleasure.
Walter Echo Hawk is a Native American attorney, tribal judge, author, and law professor, and the University of Hawaii at Manoa's Spring 2018 Dan and Maggie Inouye Distinguished Chair in Democratic Ideals. He'll present a keynote lecture tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. in the UH Art Auditorium that is free and open to the public.
I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And I'm Bert Lum.
Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll talk about the resurgence of ulu, or breadfruit, as a natural food source in Hawaii.
We'll hear how the Breadfruit Institute of the National Tropical Botanical Garden is working to reestablish Hawaii's breadfruit crop.
That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a Honolulu newspaper man who's believed to be the inventor of snowboarding. He was an advertiser editor who wrote a whimsical column about the weather under the name Sol Pluvius. The name means rainy sun, and it's as good a description of Hawaii weather as you could hope for. When he adapted his surfing skills to snow in the California mountains, his newspaper reported, "Yesterday, Saul showed the natives a new trick, snow surfing, or as Saul calls it, snurfing. The name surfing didn't snick, and it's probably just as well, but the sport has become the latest addition to the upcoming Winter Olympics. As to Sol Pluvius, he went on to a distinguished career as a war correspondent and reporter on Asia and the Pacific under his real name, and that is Robert Trumbull. And nobody got that. We stumped you on that one. But that is today's quiz. And if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping to prepare students for the SBA exam with topical content and practice for the types of questions found on the test. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
It's one of the shortcomings of most historical archives, the past as told to us by those who got their names in the paper, public officials, and those who are celebrated for whatever reason. The stories of everyday people don't often get recorded. University of Hawaii West Oahu's Center for Labor Education and Research is collating a priceless archive of Hawaii's history, unedited first-person reminiscences of plantation life. CLEAR, as it's called, is working to digitize, preserve, and catalog the Rice and Roses Plantation History Collection, thousands of videotapes. We spoke with documentary producer and UH West Oahu faculty member Chris Conybeare about the work and its importance.
It's important because the voices that we are making available tell us about our history from a very personal point of view. These are not politicians, and these are not the movers and shakers. Although they were movers and shakers, but their voices could get lost, and that their perspective on a very important part of Hawaii history needs to be heard and needs to be revived, and the next generations need to know what their great-great-great-grandparents went through and what it was like.
What was it like?
It was hard. People came here from Japan not knowing exactly what they were getting into. They were told all kinds of things, and they got here, and they were all of a sudden working 6-7 days a week. They were working 10-12 hours a day. The pay that they received was sometimes much less than they thought they were going to get. They were told things like they would be able to participate perhaps in government, and they really weren't able to. It was hard work, backbreaking, hard work, and yet they, like many immigrants, did it.
Persevered, right?
They persevered, but it wasn't easy. And it wasn't this, story of, we always like to tell the story that, they really did fine and everything was great. Mm-hmm. Well, it was really much harder than that. It was kind of like a frontier. There was gambling. There was prostitution. There was starvation. There was people running away from husbands and wives. There were all these stories that were going on that talked about a community that was really facing hard times. Those parts of history, we don't want to get covered up. We want people to remember exactly how it was.
And yet there's a tendency to prettify our history.
The old oaken bucket syndrome. Yeah, it was all wonderful on the plantation. And
Hana Butta days.
We had such a great community, and some of that's true.
Yeah.
But the other part of it needs to be told as well.
Well, I think if you're going to understand the whole nature of the social contracts that were created, you have to understand the adversity that it overcame.
That's right. I mean, the fact of the matter is that people were locked into basically indentured servitude.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them never made enough money to pay off the company store.
Yeah.
So, we talk about those things happening in the South, but they happened here as well.
There also, we had a system of marital arrangements that was, based on the whole picture bride phenomenon. And those marriages lasted in spite of their origins.
Many did, but an awful lot of them didn't. We've talked to people, and the part of the problem culturally is that on the record, not so much. Off the record, we heard from picture brides who ran away from several husbands, never got divorces, and remarried.
Really?
Some picture brides came here and were basically forced into prostitution to pay off gambling debts. There was a lot of things going on that we now look at, and certainly there were marriages that were just as successful or more so than most of the ones that happen today through love marriages.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have both stories. And we need to remember that history is not always pretty.
Well, those troubling stories reveal a great deal, and they also, one of the things they reveal is our tendency to avoid troubling stories when we look at the past.
Right. Well, we do have, I mean, the good stories, and there are some really positive, wonderful stories that this archive is capturing, and, you know, it's worth hearing those as well.
Sure.
Because you think, well, how could people do all this? How could they survive? And you listen to these folks talk about it, and you say, wow, isn't that a great story? So we have those kinds of moments. I think the other thing to remember about this is immigration. You know, immigration is a big topic now. Immigration from Asia was not really favored by the United States or the powers that be in Hawaii. I mean, there were severe limits. The reason we had picture brides is that the United States made what they called a gentleman's agreement prohibiting people to come unless they were married. So people got married long distance via pictures. So that's how they came in. So between 1908 and 1924, hundreds of thousands of people came. But immigrants from Asia were looked at askance. There was a Chinese Exclusion Act. There were a lot of barriers to immigration. And yet, because of the economic needs here, there were ways found around it.
We just needed the workers in the fields.
200,000 Japanese immigrants between 1885 and 1924. Interestingly enough, this is the 150th anniversary of the first immigrants that came in 1868, and that was a small group of maybe 150, and it didn't really work. I mean, it started it, but it wasn't until 1885 that the large-scale immigration happened. And that has to do with economic factors in Japan and the U.S., the amount of preparation that was done and things like that. But this is the 150th anniversary of the very first Japanese immigration here to Hawaii.
And most of the time when you read an account of Hawaii's history, you would read things like X number of people arrived during these years, overview things. Right.
Right.
The value of an archive like this is that this is a personal stories from people that nobody ever heard of. What was it like to be one of those 200,000?
Exactly. And our stories are everything from picture bride stories and the next group that we're going to be digitizing, preserving, and then making available. So it's not just having them in the archive, but we plan to be making smaller versions of these stories for curriculum development so that teachers in high schools and at the university can use them as personal examples. So basically, the whole idea is, yes, let's get the real person perspective on what was going on.
It also allows you to kind of create a generation of historical researchers who are using material that no one has seen before.
That's right. I mean, we used excerpts from these interviews and documentaries we did, and, you know, we would interview somebody for an hour and use 30 seconds on air.
Yeah.
But we kept the whole hour. So there's a lot of material there that has not been exposed to the public view for some time, and we're really proud of the ability to get this stuff out there.
And as long as there's material that hasn't been examined, there are new things to be learned.
There certainly are new things to be learned, and I think the other thing is that since I work with students and with educators, people are really not that aware of this history. I mean, we know the kind of romantic notions.
Right.
But people aren't really aware of the struggles. People aren't really aware of, you know, what their great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents went through. They never, and within the families, they very often didn't talk about it. So I was very lucky because I would go to, I was new here, Howley boy from Cleveland, and these folks would bring me into their house and we would sit down and they would say, Chris, you're asking me questions I wish my kids or grandchildren would ask. Mm. And they never have. So I was really privileged, really felt lucky that people would tell these stories. And so we want to share them.
It's tough to understand the present without some understanding of the past, isn't it?
Have to know the past. To know what the future is going to be, you better know what happened before.
Chris Conybear is an attorney and documentary filmmaker on the faculty of the University of Hawaii West Oahu's Center for Labor Education and Research. You can learn more about the project on our Facebook page.
Aloha, I'm Grant Miyashiro with the Ninja Monkeys. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Bernie Madoff was a supervillain to most.
This is a man that done stole more money than anybody else.
But a superhero to some.
He's more important than Jesse James. You know what I mean? Bonnie and Clyde.
Are we safe from another Ponzi ripoff?
Cash rules everything around me. Green, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, y'all.
On the next reveal.
This evening at 7.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll be hosting a panel discussion of all things housing, and we'll be taking your calls.
Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. This program and all our past ones are available on the Conversation page at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.